Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a broadcaster and a writer, but for the purposes of this podcast, I'm your Inspector Clouseau. I will be exploring an artwork in great detail, pulling out the secrets and the clues hidden within, and hopefully shedding light on some of our best loved, best known artworks. I am in the company of a very able assistant today, Jim Peters, my very close friend, fellow muso, but more importantly, curator of, now get help me out here.
Collections manager, to give me my proper title.
Collections manager of?
Well, it's Britain, Europe and prehistory here at the British Museum. So that doesn't really tell you much, but I look after the collections that stem back 1.8 million years ago to the earliest stone tools from Tanzania, right up to contemporary sort of Scandic glassware and Norwegian basketry. So rather a lot of stuff.
And so you have got the dream job. I'm so envious of your job because you really do get to rummage around the collections of the British Museum. You have it all to yourself, the keys to every door.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, that's what I'm here for, to any handling of objects that needs to be done with our collections. That's my responsibility to make sure it happens.
And so, we met years ago because you brought out the wonderful treasures that I've encountered in filming.
Yes.
And you have to stand there and make sure that us crazy presenters don't drop things.
That's right. And behave. So, but this is nice to get a chance to actually sit down and just, yeah, wax lyrical over one single individual treasure. It's rather special, this, I think. So.
And we're in a secret back room.
Yep.
And we have a very exciting thing for you listeners, because in previous episodes, we've looked at artworks on screens, in books, we've encountered a few, but today, Jim has done the most extraordinary thing. He has taken out this particular treasure. We have it here in front of us, and I can't tell you how excited I am. For me, this is one of the most magnificent pieces from my favourite period of history. I am in the presence of the Sutton Hoo shoulder clasps, just the most stunning gold and garnet cloisonné objects, mouth-watering. I first got to see them 16 years ago. Jim knows this story.
Yep.
I was a giddy MA student, and I haven't seen them in the flesh like this since then. So you've done me a huge favour.
It's one of the perks of the job, to be able to get things like this off display or out of the stores and re-engage with them. And wow, there is nothing like the Sutton Hoo shoulder clasps. There really isn't. They're unique.
And still, after all these years, because you've been here, what, 17 years?
17 years, yeah.
And after all those years, they still get
absolutely,
you.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and especially today, having got them off display, because I walk past the cases and check cases every day in the mornings, but so I see them every day. And to an extent that can make you a bit blasé about them. So to open the case and then take them off and look at them in the flesh, as it were, was just, it kind of reinvigorates the enthusiasm. You suddenly realise, oh, wow, they are just stunning pieces.
They are absolutely extraordinary. So we should probably describe them for the listeners. So they are, what, about 15, 20 centimetres across by about 8 centimetres, 9 centimetres high. There's a pair That's the other amazing thing. We've got all four sections because currently in front of us, you've got them with the pins out.
Yep.
So you can see how the mechanism actually worked. Now, these were designed to go on the shoulders and hold up a leather. Curious, weren't they?
I mean, there's also the thought that maybe it would have been a lighter, sort of more cloak-like sort of item of clothing than originally they thought it was leather, but now because we're studying the loops underneath and, you know, things change all the time. But the idea, yes, is that they sit over the shoulders and they're hinged, so they give a greater flexibility. And they have these amazing pins with, and I'm never quite sure what animal that is meant to be on.
This is the other thing that's exciting. I'm going to be able to touch them. I have my obligatory blue gloves on, but can I pick them up?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay.
And
this is where I get a bit faint. Oh my goodness. Right. Is it heavy?
Very heavy.
Really? Yeah. I'm only holding one section of the four.
I mean, between them, there are 184 grams of gold between the two pairs.
And are these, so they're solid gold inset?
Yeah.
And that is such a chunk of gold.
And gold, you know, the further back really in history you go, the purer the gold tends to be, you know, because they're not really adding anything to it to make it more malleable, more workable, which gold happens with gold now. But it tends to be as it comes.
Yeah, it's not alloyed down, is it,
no,
at all?
No, so it's really, really, they are quite a weight.
But also I think what's amazing when you see them out like this, so I'm turning one half over now, and you can see the array of the hooks on the back. Yeah. And so that would have been, I've always thought leather was too thick. I've always thought it had to be probably good, solid English wool.
I mean, it would have, you know, you can imagine it must have been something quite spectacular and quite sort of regal looking, really, to have those attached to it. It would have been a smart bit of clothing.
Definitely.
I think the idea originally with the leather was that it follows on from a kind of the sort of Roman military.
That's it.
Sort of wear, but you're right, those loops are too small. It needed to be something quite delicate, because to put leather through there, it would have had to be in thin strips, and they would have to be very soft and wet to be able to feed them through.
But it still works, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
So the technology of this is that you could still put it together, pin goes in.
Yeah, I mean, the reason they're separated is because it helps us explain to the public when they're on display exactly how they work. But we could equally display them joined, you know. In fact, they used to be displayed joined with the pin in place. And then when they're together, you get the real sense of the curve of them and how that sits on the shoulders.
Exactly. And I mean, let's put it into context again in terms of date. We're talking about 625 for Sutton Hoo ship burial, aren't we?
Yeah. So these, I mean, again, the dating of this is something that people aren't entirely sure of. And obviously it predates the burial. We don't know how far in front of the burial these were made. But it's 6th century, I think, really, late 6th century, early 7th.
7th,
yeah. Yeah.
And in terms of where these were found, I mean, when I teach on the Sutton Hoo ship burial, I always say it's England's Tutankhamun's tomb, really.
Absolutely. No, without a shadow of a doubt, I think that's completely right. And I mean, it's just like Tutankhamun has its fantastic kind of backstory. The Sutton Hoo does as well, because the land belonged to, it was Mrs. Edith Pretty.
Yeah.
And she'd been having, if I remember the story right, she'd been having recurring dreams about something underneath the mounds on her land. Her land was sort of covered in dips and mounds. And she contacted, contacted Basil Brown directly.
Yeah.
Who's a famous archaeologist at the time, and said, would you come and have a look? I'm sure there's something under here.
It's such a prosaic story, isn't it? The names, Edith Pretty and Basil Brown.
It's brilliant. It's absolutely
love
brilliant.
It.
And he came and he excavated and, found just amazing things. You know, it was a ship burial. So by that, it means there was a ship.
Yeah.
I mean, the ship had rotted away. But we've got all the rusty rivets here.
Well, that's what he was so good at, Basil, wasn't he? Because he was quite good at it. It's in East Anglia, Sutton Hoo, on the edge, looking out towards Scandinavia, if you like.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of, we can talk about the Scandinavian influence on the Sutton Hoo ship burial. But the way that he excavated was he very carefully left the rivets in place.
Yeah.
He didn't plunder them, which is what archaeologists had been prone to do.
Yeah, no, he was a new breed, you know, that new breed of archaeologists that I think kind of understood the fact that everything had to be done methodically and logically and had to be recorded. And it's a real boon to us that he approached it like that, because the information we've been able to get is, you know, unprecedented, really. It's even if you take away what was found there, the information just from the excavation itself is, you know, changed our thinking of things, I think, really.
I mean, Sutton Hoo changed so much. Yeah. It changed everything. I mean, I'm a medievalist studying the Anglo-Saxon period, and you've got sort of pre-Sutton Hoo scholarship and post-Sutton Hoo scholarship, and the two are not the same thing. It rewrote all the books.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to remember that, you know, there are so many barrows and mounds on the English landscape, but they're all robbed, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, it was one of those sort of Sunday afternoon activities for the rich and landed gentry to go out and stick a hole down the middle of a local barrow. And sadly, we've lost a lot, but fortunately that isn't what happened at Sutton Hoo. And I mean this excavations still happen that are ongoing there, you know, like late 90s they were still excavating there. This was 1937 was the original excavation, but there's a whole cemetery of sand bodies there where, you know, then there's just so much, but it's known for the ship burial, and I suppose really it's known for the helmet. That's the iconic thing. And I always say that, you know, the Sutton Hoo helmet is probably the second most famous helmet in the entire world. And I would say the first most famous helmet is Darth Vader's helmet.
Wow!
Darth Vader's helmet, though, is reputed to have been based and inspired on the Sutton Hoo helmet.
So it all comes around.
Yes, but if you pick up a book anywhere in the world, and it covers the Anglo-Saxon period, there will probably be a picture of the Sutton Hoo helmet. So that's what I think, that's the iconic thing. But actually, you know, once you've taken that in, go around the side of the case and have a look at the shoulder clasps and have a look at the rest of the treasures, and they are, you know, to me they overshadow the helmet. As amazing as it is and as iconic as the helmet is, it doesn't hold a, you know, torch to these.
I have to agree. I mean, I think that the whole story of the Sutton Hoo ship burial, I can talk about it for days. You know, you go around each artifact and you have a whole world view there in that one burial. You have, you know, enamel from Ireland, you've got Byzantine silver dishes, you've got you know, imports from the continent, the Frankish coins. I mean, that's what we use to date the Sutton Hoo ship burial, isn't it? It's the coins.
Yeah, and it's the whole world at that time.
Yeah,
in one excavation, and even to the extent that, you know, for me, one of the most interesting aspects of it, which I try and infuse people with when we're in the gallery, but I'm not sure it ever works, is we've got the rusty cauldron chain. Which in the new display we're able to show in its full length.
Almost, it's looped over at the top. It's not even high enough to take it.
Well, that was an oversight on the case, but and not my fault. But the thing with that is, obviously, by being able to tell the length of the cauldron chain, meant that we were able to then work out the dimensions of the Great Hall. And the Great Hall is, you know, that's so central to that period of living. You know, that's where Beowulf starts.
Exactly.
So it was aside of all these wonderful things, even just something so simple as the length of a chain found on the site. It really is, you know, it really is it changed everything,
because I think up until that point there was this sense of the Anglo-Saxon period being a dark age.
We
don't use that term now, but no. But being a time when the lights went out and everyone lived in tiny little Grubenhauser, little hovels in the ground, and because they lived in massive timber halls, which we're only finding with archaeological developments and sort of post-hole technology, there was no evidence for that in the record, and so people just didn't believe in the literary idea of the hall, did they? Beowulf talks about the hall. Beowulf talks about that being, as you say, this hub of culture and society.
Yeah, it was completely.
But until Sutton Hoo, we had no evidence for it.
And that suddenly, it was, like you say, the Sutton Hoo turned the light on, I think, really, didn't it? And that was it. Like you were saying earlier, sort of pre-Sutton Hoo and post-Sutton Hoo. Pre-Sutton Hoo, it was very much that idea of it was uncultured and, you know, the Romans gone and no one sort of cared anymore. It was just plundering everything and using it to whatever, and had no culture and no sense of artistic design or anything. And then suddenly Sutton Hoo was found and all those people had to stop talking and rethink their opinions. And and add central to all of that, I think, because there is nothing else like the shoulder clasp.
Nothing.
You know, other things you can compare and you can say that's like that, that's like that, that came from here, that came the shoulder class. You just have to take as an individual thing because there is nothing else like that.
To me, they are just, I had some students where I was explaining to them the technology that went into making it, which we could discuss as well. But the student went, oh, they have to have come from space. There is something beyond I've known them for so long. I've looked at them so many times. And the thing is, your mind can imagine the sorts of craftsmanship, the skill that the craftsman that made this had. But there comes a point where it gets so microscopic, so detailed, that it actually beggars belief. If they're doing this without electricity, without running water.
Exactly. This is the I still, even though, like you say, I know the techniques or you know, I've had to explain how these things were made, I still can't quite believe it.
Yeah.
And in fact, I was watching a program, the Orkney program that's been on recently, and Neil Oliver said whenever he goes to Scarborough, he's always got this kind of there's 5% in the back of his head that doesn't believe it's real.
Yeah,
he's always like Scarborough is so perfect that there's a bit of him that thinks we've got it wrong and someone made that not that long ago because how can it be what it is? And I think that's saying the show. I genuinely cannot quite get my head around the fact that someone is able to make that.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter how many times you look at it doesn't matter how long you study it, these are things that push you to the limits of what you think.
Like you said, there's no electricity. No. It's the strongest light you've got is the natural daylight and however many hours you've got of that day. There's magnification.
Exactly.
You know, it's just what they had to produce this is, and yet they managed it. And I don't think it's not the sort of thing that you can make nowadays, I don't think.
Well, we did some research when we did Trash of the Anglo-Saxons and we went to Asquiths and asked them how long, and they would do it now with lasers. They couldn't do it by the naked eye. And it would take months and it would cost hundreds of thousands of pounds to make one. Mm. And that's with all our modern technology.
Yeah.
You know. But this, we have to put this into its context. This is happening in, you know, the turn of the 6th century into the 7th century, and this is gold and garnet that is being worked so exquisitely. I mean, there is a fashion for gold and garnet in the Anglo-Saxon period, isn't there? The Staffordshire hoard has reinforced that.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing that's amazing about these is that it's the quantity. You know, you have to have the quantity of that much of the raw materials to be able to do it. Mm. You know, to have that quantity of garnets to be able, you either have to be unbelievably precise with every single cut you make. And when you look at the size of some of these, you know, some of the sort of the zoomorphic kind of interlacing designs, which are all inlaid, are just, you know, it's millimetres. You're literally cutting millimetres of garnet to drop into these settings. You either have to be unbelievably confident and precise, or you have to have enough of the raw material that you can
waste it.
You can waste it. Either of those two sort of are incredible.
Because the garnet's coming from, where do we think, Eastern Europe, Africa?
Yeah, I think. And I mean, that's the considered opinion that it's come up from, maybe Afghanistan or come across to Europe. And I think the glass, the sort of millefiori glass, I think is Roman glass that's been reused.
But the gold, even the gold, because that's one of the other things I find interesting. They're importing the garnet, they're importing the glass, they're importing the gold. It's not Welsh gold, it's not native gold, which has that sort of rosy tint to it.
Yeah.
This has had to have travelled as well, hasn't it?
Exactly, and again, that just adds to the picture of what, you know, how important whoever this was, but also the fact that. It wasn't a dark age.
Definitely.
You know,
it's cosmopolitan, it's international. Yeah. People are trading vast distances.
Yeah. You're not trading sort of commodities. You're not trading so that you can eat.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
And that you can look after your livestock and trade livestock. You're trading something that goes into something like this. That's so sophisticated. And, you know, to go and source that sort of material to be able to make something like this, it's mind-blowing, really.
And then to put it in the ground.
Yeah.
Your culture is so luxurious that you've got enough to actually put this in as a death offering. I mean, that's the other thing about, that I suppose we should say about this Sutton Hoo ship burial. It is a burial.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I know that Puritans question whether there was a body there because there is no trace.
The
soil was so acidic,
wasn't it? Yeah.
It's eaten away any trace. But the positioning of everything, these are the accoutrements of a very, very wealthy Anglo-Saxon.
Incredibly.
From pre-Christian time. This is on the edge. This is on that turning point.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the iconography that's used, the symbolism that's used in all the pieces shows that it's that sort of pre-Christian period. But there's been many kind of different interpretations as to who this person was. And to be perfectly honest, I don't subscribe to any of them.
Really? Don't even go with the Radwald idea?
Well, I mean, it could be, but then it might not be. So I'd rather just stand in wonder, really, rather than, you know, take a very kind of sort of Zen approach to it and just like admire it for what it is rather than overthinking it.
I like that. I tend to come down on the side that if it is going to be anyone, it's going to be Radwald, King of the East Anglians, this slippery character in Bede who converts to Christianity and then goes back to his Germanic pagan gods. And so, I mean, it's almost too easy with Sutton Hoo because you have things like the baptismal spoons in the collection. There's this suggestion of Christianity hovering around the edges. Yeah. But what it is at its core is a very Germanic burial in a ship, with all the goods that he would need for Valhalla, for the afterlife.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, it's this idea of investment in death, isn't it? This is a huge investment.
Yeah, and then this is it. I mean, I was saying earlier about that quote, which is probably a good time to sort of mention, that I was reading a bit of background about this, and I came across this quote, which is supposedly Theodoric the Great, was apparently reputed to as he was donning his armour for battle. He was quoted as saying, "Let them at least say how splendid he looks in death, if they have not had the chance to admire me in fighting." And that's what this is. This is someone who's saying, you know, whatever happens to me afterwards, I'm going to look fantastic.
I'm going to look fantastic in death.
No, I'm going to have stuff that no one else has got, and I'm going to take it with me. I'm not even going to leave it behind for anyone. I'm keeping this.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, there is this genuine belief that there is an afterlife that is for fighting and feasting and being magnificent. I mean, I would say to you earlier that the curator of the Staffordshire Horde described to me this military elite, the sort of Germanic warriors that we have commemorated in Beowulf and commemorated in things like Sutton Hoo. They are psychopathic peacocks. They look incredible and they'll chop your head off while they look. And this is sort of the ultimate warrior bling, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, and I mean, I sort of, again, interpreting who owned them and what they were used for. I mean, this isn't even something that you would wear in battle. This is just showing off. Like I said, this is complete peacock. But the kind of, even the image on the boar of it, I was looking at, and I found that, for me, that's quite a confusing image, because obviously the boar's been used before by the Romans, and it was a kind of a legionary thing, and it was a very kind of proud, strong creature. And then you get it as a hunting animal. Mm-hmm. It's being hunted, and it's normally running. So, whereas these, it's this weird kind of sort of interlocking, and it's like it's grazing. Mm. So it's not the kind of the strong military symbolism, and it's not the kind of the hunting symbolism. Mm. It's something else. This is something else. I don't know what that is, but
I could give you a sort of way of thinking about it, which is if we ever do look at these creatures, because Anglo-Saxon art has a very limited vocabulary of birds and beasts.
Yeah.
You get the hook-beak bird.
Yeah.
You get the serpents, which we've got writhing around the margins and up in the legs.
Yeah, which you don't even notice unless you get the chance to hold them really, really close.
Well, God, I mean, the filigree ones, which actually, I'm going to pick it up again. Is that
I mean, yeah, I mean, no one would notice those.
No,
if you were wearing them, nobody would notice them, but they're
there. For personal rumination. I mean, this is the thing I've absolutely love about the Anglo-Saxons is their love of riddles, visual and verbal riddles. Like, to them, they haven't got television or podcasts. They're going to sit and ruminate on these objects and their mind will pore over the details. So, yeah, you've mentioned the boars, and in between the legs of the boars are these beautiful gold serpents that are done with the gold beading. Look at the dimensions of that beading. I mean, that needs a microscope to almost see each individual bead.
Yeah, you can't really see it properly with the naked eye.
You can't. I mean, they almost blur into one, but they are individual gold beads.
Yeah.
And the boars are really interesting. I mean, so many people struggle to see them, so don't worry if you're listening to this and you can't see the boars. But there are two that overlap on the end of each of the each half of the shoulder clasp. And what's important to notice is that it's the tail end that's at the edge. So you can see the sort of curly pigtail at the edge, and then the prickly spine, and then the two heads hang down in the middle. And like you say, Jim, it's like they're grazing. Their snouts are sort of shoved down on the ground. Interestingly, I think that the serpents that are writhing underneath and the boar both had a role within Germanic mythology, didn't they? So Yggdrasil is the world serpent. But the boars pulled the chariot of Freya, the virility god.
Yeah.
So in a way, these are really good thing for a guy, a big macho guy to work. It's like I'm virile, I'm masculine, I'm all man, you know.
But you're right, it's kind of there's a riddle there because you have to be able to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. And you have to play with it. You have to have it up close.
Yeah, and I think that's another thing. It's that you almost feel that because it's a riddle, once you've worked it out, there's something there. There's a status there. Even if it's just to yourself, you kind of think, wow, I've seen it. I understand it. I know what's going on here.
Well, it's about the initiates, isn't it? I mean, that's the thing about a lot of religious art is only the initiates can understand it. And actually, that's kind of what's going on here. And I mean, we see boar's tusks, don't we, in Anglo-Saxon graves. That's always a sign of this sort of masculinity, virility, fertility. I mean, boar's tusks are ground up, aren't they? I think they're ground up as a potent sort of Viagra thing.
And it was the Romans as well. You would use sort of pendants made out of boar's tusks. And again, a very, very strong sort of male
macho symbol. Thing. Yeah. So the boars are there and then the serpents are there. But you know what we must really discuss is the techniques that went into making this.
Well, that's it. I was just saying, when you're holding it, just moving it around, and you suddenly, it's what's going on, not just with the inlay, but what's going on underneath the inlay.
It's just mind-bending.
It's just too much, isn't it? Because it's decorated underneath where the garnets have been cut and inlaid. It's decorated with a kind of a gold foil that's been sort of scratched or etched with a kind of a crisscross pattern. But which means that as it moves, it not only does the stone catch the light, but the light is reflected in many different ways by what's going on underneath. But then when you pick it up and look at it, each individual one is kind of got a slightly different treatment.
It's unbelievable. So, I mean, I'm feeling kind of giddy, actually, because I've got it right up close to my eyes. I mean, I'm able to see inside the cloisons. And this cloisonné setting itself, I mean, God, I mean, you see it blown up on a big screen and it still doesn't make sense. But these are individually created receptacles made out of gold. Yeah. And then the gems are put in, but they're not, there's no adhesive, is
no,
there? That's
no.
done purely through the tension of gemstone against gemstone.
They're dropped in and they have to be absolutely precise. You know, they have to be, the gemstone has to be cut exactly for the aperture that it's being dropped into.
And it's been sat in an acid bath for 1,000 Yeah. 300, 400 well, years, and it's still intact.
Yeah, I mean, it's masterful. But the one thing you have to remember, and this is one of the kind of the great things about the Sutton Hoo treasures, is that although there's quite a bit of silverware there as well, the main treasures that were found where the body would have been are gold or made of gold, the buckle and the purse and such, and the belt as well. And gold pretty much comes out of the ground the same as it went in. So when Basil Brown discovered these, when he knocked back the earth and found the shoulder clasp, this is pretty much what he would have seen. You know, he wouldn't have had to have done much to it to have had the same sort of, you know, experience we're having now.
Well, I remember when you've just recently re-exhibited the Sutton Hoo treasures in the British Museum. Yeah. And I remember you saying, because I said, oh gosh, the gold buckle's had a good clean-up. It looks fantastic.
And no, it hasn't.
It hasn't.
That's just how it looks. It always looks like that. It's just, and it's such pure gold, you know. We have to wear gloves, obviously, so we don't get fingerprints on it. The silver would tarnish if we got fingerprints. The gold doesn't. But other than that, this is, you know, this is how it would have looked at the time.
Mm.
Other things you kind of sometimes have to project. It would have looked like this because the colours have gone or whatever, surface damage. But with these things, you really don't. This is how they were. And I'm just looking at that. And even when you look at the boar's snout, that they used a completely different technique underneath on the foil.
Yeah.
That's kind of like that's pinpricked,
well,
as opposed to cross hatching. And it's just,
this is where this sort of the extraterrestrial bit comes in. I can't understand the cross hatching, the gold leaf. So behind each sliver of garnet, and garnet's tough to cut, it shatters quite easily, but behind each bit, as you say, is this gold foil, and the gold foil has been incised or stamped, actually, isn't it, with a checkerboard.
Mm-hmm.
And what you can't see with the naked eye, but you can see when you blow it up, is that you can see the initial checkerboard, can't you? The sort of crisscross hatchings.
Yeah.
Inside each of those squares is another checkerboard.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's where it starts to just blow your brain.
I mean, it adds, it's so 3D, because obviously you've got the kind of the checkerboard layout of the garnets on, not round the bore, but the main sort of like curve.
Yeah.
Really. That itself is a checkerboard. And then the millefiori glass is checkerboard.
Yeah.
And then you've got the etching of that, and those multiple layers of kind of repeating the similar sort of pattern just creates such depth and such sort of a 3D effect, which is,
do you know what I've never noticed until now, holding it at an angle, is the millefiori glass. It's some of it's inset, some of it's raised. That it's a real kind of visual riddle, because your eye can't make sense of the depth of some of these cells, can
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
And I think that's amazing, because actually one of the things that always strikes me about these is if you looked at them on shoulders and they didn't have those reflective back plates, they would be quite dull. Garnet is quite a dark gem, and it would be very, very smooth, because actually you run your finger over it, it's so smooth that there wouldn't actually be much dimension going on there at all.
Oh,
but but they've mastered the idea of light, the idea that the light beam will go in through that gem, hit the back plate, sparkle out and create something dramatic. That's true artistry.
Oh, absolutely. It's taking it beyond just creating nice shoulder clasps. This puts it in completely differently. And I mean, even with the quite plain and boring sort of the stepped rhomboid bit of it, that's the kind of thing you'll see on sword pommels and sword hilts. And so that's nothing new, but the way it's been done and what they've done underneath it, and then what they surround, you know, it's just, there is nothing else like this. And if you try to find comparative pieces to the Sutton Hoo shoulder clasp, what you end up doing is saying, oh, they use that technique on something that isn't nearly as good.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, oh, that's a similar kind of imagery as you find on that, which isn't really the same and isn't nearly as good. There isn't any kind of, you can't compare like for like when you're looking at with quite a few of the bits of Sutton Hoo, but I think the shoulder clasps are the ones that stand out on their own, as you will never find anything else.
No.
Unless they're still in the ground and you haven't found them yet.
Well, and then Staffordshire Hoard appears and you get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of new examples of this same conservative tradition of golden garnet. But you're absolutely right. You look there and you still come back to this and you still say, this is the master worker. This is your, you know, your Turner, your Picasso. This is your master craftsman of his time. And because, let's be honest, this is probably a royal burial.
Yeah.
And so this is the person who is patronising this craftsman has got the best craftsman.
Yeah. And like we're saying, to have that ready supply of raw material, yeah. you would have the best person working with it.
Yeah.
And it shows, you know, it's masterful. The way that there's just so much about it that's amazing. But the way they slope, the sort of the shape of them, the pin, the detail, everything is just stunning, really.
And I suppose this is the point at which we combat the elephant in the room, which is that this is an art detective podcast. A lot of people will say, "Is this art?"
Well, and it's funny because when you sort of asked me if I'd be interested in doing one of these programs, and I was in my head, I was thinking of kind of art objects, which, to be honest, we don't have a lot of in our collection because it's it's very much archaeological based. And when you suggested these, I thought, brilliant idea because they're objects, they're archaeological objects. They came out the ground and they're displayed in an assemblage, a burial in the museum. So to be able to take them aside and say, no, these are works of art, is a really, really nice, fresh way of looking at them, because they are.
I think they are. What is art? Before we have a word to pin to it, which, you know, comes post-Vasari, really, this idea of art as a discipline and the fine arts of painting, sculpture and architecture. This is the finest expression of beauty and creativity and craftsmanship that this period was capable of creating. And so, in my opinion, that makes it an artwork. It is,
absolutely. Mm. You know, if... Yeah, it's difficult to kind of put into words, and it's what I'm finding slightly awkward or slightly difficult is the fact you and I are here and we're both just grinning continually.
We are.
We're just so excited and so happy because they're here and we can see them. And whilst we're talking, we're looking at them and we can admire them. And it's really difficult to try and convey that because, and that's why I'm very privileged in the position I'm in, because I get to see these objects up close. So, I hope that people will be able to understand why these are works of art and are not just grave goods.
I think that the idea of getting the sense of how actually delicate and tiny a lot of this is, when you look at it on your screen, when you blow it up, when you zoom in, you don't really appreciate the microscopic nature of so much of this. And I think that's what it is. We like the miniatures, don't we, Jim? We like everything, the small, the detail, that skill that goes into making something
absolutely
so reduced and so perfect. They are stunning. And hopefully, Art Detective listeners, you will really take the time to really zoom in and out on these objects. Take the time to notice the details we're talking about, the skill, the technology. Before we sign off, I'm just going to pick them up once. I'm in the presence of something that is so beautiful, so perfect. And the idea that, you know, for 1,000-odd years, the last pair of eyes that looked at this, for the eyes of the Anglo-Saxons that buried the person there, that it's amazing.
They
staggering.
Are.
We're very honoured. I'm so grateful to you for this.
It's quite all right. No, it's been really good.
Oh, wow. Well, if you've enjoyed this podcast, hopefully you've enjoyed it a little bit as much as we have, because we genuinely are grinning like Cheshire cats. You can subscribe at historyhit.com/artdetective. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Dr. Yanina Ramirez. Jim, it's been amazing.
No, it's been a pleasure. It really has, to have the excuse to be able to get something like this off display and spend an afternoon looking at it with someone who's as enthusiastic about it as I am. It's been fantastic, so thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.